And it's time for the Sunday panel, looking back at the last few days of life and politics in New Zealand. And with us are the law partner Linda Clark from Denton's Kensington Swan and Richard Harman from the Politic website. Modena, Linda, good morning, Richard.
Good morning. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning, everybody.
Michelle Bogue, the last few days have underscored for me the unhealthy relationship I have developed with politics. Richard, do you think that applies to everyone in politics?
Well, I thought Michelle's statement was a remarkable confession. She said that, and she said that sometimes she had tried too hard. I think there is a streak running through politics of these days where people believe that a small minority of people believe that the ends justify the means. We've seen it most recently in the National Party. Obviously, this week we saw it with some of the revelations that emerged around Jamie Lee Ross, and we, of course, saw it also with the book Dirty Politics. I think it's stronger in the National Party at the moment because they don't believe they lost the last election. They have this sense of grievance. They believe that all they have to do, many of them will believe that all they have to do to get back to power is somehow or another demolish the Labour Party and in particular the Prime Minister. You see that on Twitter and you hear them talk about it. I think it is an issue for the new leadership, and so far the new leadership have not indicated that they're willing to grapple with it.
Linda, what do you think about that, and also about Audrey Young and the New Zealand Herald saying this leaking saga is not done, and what questions do you have over it still?
Well, it's definitely not done. I think it's got a long way to go yet. I mean, I think there's a lot to unpick here, and a lot to unpick in what Richard said, and a lot of what he said I agree with. I mean, Bogue's statement, yes, it was remarkable, but it was a remarkable statement written by a remarkable PR person, because that is what she is. I mean, she has had an incredible career, and she's very good at this. But I don't think this was a new thing, her so-called unhealthy relationship with politics. I mean, Michelle Bogue has been in politics since she was about 22 years of age, and she's been involved in some real imbroglios over the years, from the wine box inquiry in the 1990s when she was accused of misleading a commission of inquiry. She's been involved in allegations of privacy breaches before in relation to ACC information. I mean, this goes back. So for her, this is not a new unhealthy relationship. This has been the way that she's operated from time to time when the chips are down. Richard's right, though. Particularly at the moment in National, there is this view that they shouldn't have lost the last election. And that has always been so surprising to me, actually, because, you know, we've been an MMP system since 1996. This is how MMP works. It doesn't always tilt your way, but no political system does. And in politics, you've just got to get up the next day if you've lost, gather the team, and fight again. But the word fight there doesn't mean you fight dirty. It doesn't mean you try to demolish anybody. It means that you try to put your best foot forward, your best policy forward, and convince voters. Now, the thing that's really upset me this week, and I honestly was shocked this week because, as long in the tooth as I am, what we're talking about is the deliberate leaking of private information. And it doesn't matter which way you look at that, which lens you look at it, that is against the law. So every one of us gives our information to health providers, and I'm assuming that this information originally was collected by district health boards or a doctor's clinic or the Ministry of Health, but some health body. We give that information to those bodies, and they are required under the law to only use it for the purpose for which it was collected. That's it. Now, however Michelle Bogue got the information, and I think there's a big question over that as to whether or not she should have had it, but she was given it. From the minute she had it, she was obliged and required under the law to not give it to anybody else who wasn't meant to have it, and she did. And Walker and Woodhouse, when they got it, they should have known this is private information, and however they got it, they were obliged not to do anything with it. Now, Michael Woodhouse says, he never did. But the reason why he never did is so telling, because in the interviews that he's done this week, when he was asked about why what he did with it. His actual quote was, "I saw it was patient information, and clearly there was nothing that I could benefit from, and I did not use it." So he doesn't say, clearly it was illegal that I had it. Clearly this was something that I needed to do something about immediately. No, he didn't. He looked to his own interests first. And when he said there was nothing I could benefit from, what he meant was, going back to Richard's point, I couldn't use this to demolish anyone, so I did nothing with it. Now, that is absolutely appalling.
Unless it's just a curious turn of phrase, but I'd like to ask Richard, given what you've said, Linda, the further implications then, what do you think is going to happen, Richard?
Well, first of all, there is the Mike Heron inquiry. Linda's right. The big question is, how did Michelle Bogue get that information? There are dark hints from elements within the National Party in Parliament that she may face more than privacy charges on this. I think she's almost certain to face privacy charges. But I think what it really does do is raise very serious questions about the Todd Muller leadership. Now, go back to Tuesday night when we got those two remarkable press statements from Bogue and Walker. Muller put out an anodyne press release that night, virtually said nothing. Right until late in the evening, there was no indication that National were actually going to do anything about this. And then suddenly the next morning we learned he'd written to the party's board. It looked to me as though there needed to be a hell of a lot of pressure put on him from somewhere to get him to that position. He looked indecisive, and the party and the leadership as a whole, and they talk about this triangle leadership involving Todd Muller, Nikki Kaye, and Amy Adams, and that triangle, to me, looked indecisive and weak. Now, I've got an email here from one of National's most prominent former ministers, and it reads, "This is a massive reputational failure. It destroys the NAT's license to operate." And that's coming from inside one of their most supportive people. This is not ended because it has not ended inside the party, and it has not ended and should not end inside the caucus.
The core issue, can we talk about that? A spreadsheet which confirms that a lot of people have come into the country and into quarantine from Asia, but they are Kiwis, and the countries they are...
I'm not sure that's what it confirms, though. I think even that is not actually agreed on. So that's the inference at the very beginning, is that that's why it was leaked, because if you go right back, you peel it right back, Michael Woodhouse had made these claims about... Hamish Walker had made these claims about where people were coming back from, and the initial version of the story was that the information was sent to him to somehow, or that he was sending the information to journalists to somehow prove his point. But other journalists who received the information said it didn't have any information about on those documents about where people came from.
Yes, but I take your point. But even if it had, the countries they are from are arguably less virus riddled than the US, for example. So aside from the wrongness of released health information, Linda, did the premise for doing it ever stack up?
No, because the premise is based on releasing information that is protected by law. So, and you can't shift that just because it's inconvenient. So that's why this has got so much more to go, and that's why people like the former National person, minister that Richard just quoted, that's why they're so right. I mean, National's always had... all parties like this from time to time, but National has always had a struggle between those, a sort of thin vein in the party that always wants to go a little bit further, and the more traditional National Party supporters and players who actually want to play with a straight bat. And there's a real tension here. And the minute you start throwing private information around, leaking it to journalists, handing it actually, it wasn't a leak, he handed it across. Once you break the law, you break the law. You can't, there's no wiggle room with that.
21 minutes to 9. A lot of topics to talk about, though, and TY Point. Too big to fail, Richard?
Obviously not. This is a complex story, and it relates obviously to the power price, and it relates in particular to the transmission component of the power price. 2016, the Electricity Authority tried to end the system whereby we sort of have equalised transmission costs around the country. And they proposed that you pay a transmission cost based on how far you were from the nearest generator. This obviously worked in for Tiwai Point. They would have got a $20 million reduction in their power bill, but it would not have worked for Auckland, where every household would have faced a $50 a year increase. And the political pressure from Auckland persuaded Judith Collins in 2017, when she was Energy Minister, to write to the Electricity Authority, basically saying, think again. They did think again. They've come back with those thoughts after an extensive series of consultations last month, and that $20 million reduction had shrunk to $10 million. But more importantly, from both the government and Nationals' point of view, the big increase in Auckland had gone.
Do you perceive any brinkmanship going on here, though?
Well, any commercial negotiation is going to have brinkmanship in it, but it was quite interesting. There was a piece by Mark Binn, who was CEO of Meridian some years ago, and he wrote a piece in Business Desk saying that the language that New Zealand aluminium smelters were using this time was very different, and this sounded like they were really serious. Rio Tinto have made it clear around the world they want to close smelters. It's projected there'll be a 6 million ton surplus of aluminium this year, and Rio Tinto has particularly been on the warpath against two smelters, one in Iceland and one in New Zealand, where the power prices are very high.
A new poll released by the Helen Clark Foundation and the New Zealand Drug Foundation showing cannabis legislation would pass if the referendum were held today. Some questions. Do you think the Drug Foundation should be taking sides here? You might not perceive that it is, but is that how you understand its role? Linda.
Well, I should declare that I used to be on the board of the New Zealand Drug Foundation, although I haven't been for some years. So I understand what they do. No, that is their role. I mean, the role of the Drug Foundation is to provide evidence-based information on drug use, and in particular on drug harm minimisation. And the foundation, no surprises here, has always seen drug use as a health issue rather than a criminal justice issue. So I'm not surprised by the role the Drug Foundation is playing, and I think it's the same with the Helen Clark Foundation releasing information about it, and we saw this week information released by a panel which included the Chief Science Advisor. I mean, voters and all New Zealanders need reliable information on these kind of referenda because it's sometimes hard to sort out the wood from the trees. I don't know whether the referendum would pass if it was held today. I suspect there's quite a lot of people who feel pretty nervous about it for a whole lot of reasons, often about their own family circumstances, particularly what I've heard, and I guess it's because I've got teenagers. But, I mean, a lot of people I know are very nervous about it because of the signal it sends to teenagers. I don't share that nervousness, actually. I think that the reality is that the current law isn't working and is hardly used. So, from a general good policy point of view, we should only have policies and laws in place that we enforce and that are workable. I hope that answers your question.
Well, I'll ask Richard. I mean, it's welcome news, isn't it, Richard, that Helen Clark will go to bat for better treatments of pandemics on behalf of the World Health Organization. But do you understand why the foundation needs to be polling on cannabis?
Well, I assume they can poll on cannabis. I mean, if you go to their website, they've quite clearly got a dog in the fight. They are actually quite controversial, the foundation. Quite a lot of medical people are quite critical of them. It's hard, isn't it? I mean, at what point does an expert body who decides to become an advocate, where do they draw the line? Look, I don't trust polls from anybody other than the polling companies, quite frankly.
We'll get into financial and economic news a bit more next week because politics has been so dominant in the past week, and we've been talking about that. The New Zealand Herald Online, though, one house, 16 offers, buyers flood Hawke's Bay property market. But speaking of your leading politician, a leading CEO told me this week that you'd be silly to buy a house right now. What do you both think, Richard?
I think your CEO is exactly right. Everything we're seeing at the moment is the precursor to a bubble bursting, isn't it? I mean, if you stand back and look at the aggregates, we're going to have a massive increase in unemployment, which means that income flowing into potential mortgage holders' hands is going to be less, and therefore their ability to bid up house prices is going to be much reduced. Therefore, when people come to sell, perhaps early in the new year or when the wage subsidy, et cetera, is over, they're going to find an unenthusiastic market. Now, at the moment, we know there's all this pent-up demand and that there's momentum coming out of the lockdown. And a lot of people are still to lose their jobs. I mean, you can't hack 3,500 jobs out of Air New Zealand and all of these other businesses that are failing without that ultimately impacting right through the economy. It's like a sort of line of dominoes. And all of that must end up in the property market, one way or another.
All right. And only about a minute to go, Linda, but what do you think of our prospects, especially pertaining to the housing market, which is what we've decided to talk about?
Well, it's just that people are losing, we're going to have a real second wave of people losing their jobs, but we're also having this wave of new arrivals. So the government's talked about 30,000 coming through in 2 months. And why they've got the problem with the, you know, having to turn off the tap on that is they don't know how many yet are to come. And what are those people going to do? There simply aren't jobs for all of them because they're not coming here with the ambition of being a fruit picker. So I think we're going to end up with a whole new bubble of people who don't have placements, don't have places to live, don't have jobs. So, yeah, I think this is a time for great caution in all quarters.
Linda Clark, thank you. Richard Harman, thank you. Our Sunday panel.